Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 3 issues for just £5. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to Black's History Week. After the ignominy of the Vichy regime, how did post-war France recreate its government institutions, political parties and civil society? Was the Fourth Republic a failure? And what was de Gaulle's vision for his country? Professor Jeremy Black, author of the forthcoming France, A Short History, talks to The Critic's political editor, Graham Stewart, about the French experience from the liberation of 1944 through to the student unrest of 1968 and de Gaulle's resignation as president the following year.
Professor Jeremy Black, after the liberation of France, almost an entire political class had been compromised by its attitude towards the German occupation and the participation in the Vichy government. How poisonous was the Vichy regime to the notion of Republican France?
Vichy was explicitly anti-Republican in the sense that the Third Republic was held responsible by Vichy ministers and commentators for everything they thought that had gone wrong with France, including its failure in 1940. And Vichy saw itself as an opportunity to, as it were, launch a what they saw as a sort of a reformed, benign France. I mean, obviously, the practicality of that was collaboration with Germany, the deportation of Jews to be murdered, the sending abroad to work in German factories at very onerous ways of a lot of Frenchmen, some French women as well. So the actual practicality of Vichy in no way matched up to its ideology, but nevertheless, that ideology and the complicity of so many individuals had indeed compromised a lot of people.
How much of the ideology of the Vichy government was a continuation of conservative, right-wing, monarchist, and other non-socialist movements which preceded it?
Well, yes and no. I mean, in the sense that, obviously the critique that Vichy was a continuation of conservatism was to be used on the left to condemn all conservatives. I mean, I think it's well worth bearing in mind that a lot of people who fought with de Gaulle were conservatives. So, yes and no. What I would say is there are strands in the far right in the 1930s that you can see very much with Vichy. It's worth bearing in mind that collaboration with Germany took a number of forms. I mean, let's be clear about this. In 1940, Germany was an ally of the Soviet Union, and the communists, who were very numerous in France, did not really oppose the Germans until after Hitler invaded the Soviet Union in the summer of 1941, which was something they subsequently did their best to forget. So I think one has to be cautious about assuming that all collaborators were people on the right, and that the right as a whole collaborated. Neither of those postulates are, I think, founded, but I think it is correct that powerful strands of anti-Republican sentiment from the 1930s, particularly political Catholicism and of a violent type, played a key role in the Vichy regime. Bear in mind, not all Vichyists were fascists. I think that's an important thing to bear in mind. And the relationship between fascism in France and political Catholicism is a complex one. And possibly on another program, we could talk a bit more about the nature, range, pathologies of 1930s and 1940s far-right politics. but you've got to be aware that it's too easy to see Vichy as a Nazi movement. It's not. There are some people within it who had similar values, shall we say, abdication of values and attitudes, not least vicious and murderous anti-Semitism. But there were many Vichyists who loathed and despised sort of the equivalent of the French fascists, not least because they saw them in sort of rather contemptible socially.
Well, there is the resistance to fascism, which comes in the shape of the Free French of de Gaulle, but there's also the resistance movements within France during the Second World War. They've come to be depicted as largely communist-controlled or communist-led. Is that depiction accurate?
Not particularly. I mean, I think it's fair to say that after Operation Barbarossa started, the communists were instructed to take part in much more, an active policy of opposition to the Germans. But I think it's fair to say that the actual local delineaments of resistance activity and indeed of collaboration varied enormously. A whole range of factors played a part. I mean, politics, as you've indicated, is one. Religion is another. Tensions within particular regions and localities, terrains, the impact of German demands for resources. There are a whole host of factors that can lead people to become resistance. And in a sense, in some areas, there's almost a local resistance, which in a way can maneuver or, as it were, as to whom it wishes to align itself with. And I think the politics of the locality is particularly significant during the resistance. They're dependent on, well, to a degree, they're dependent on the British for arms, but a lot of it is the, an attempt by both the communists and the Free French to direct people in France, many of whom do not intend particularly to be directed by outsiders.
Traumas such as that endured by France during the Second World War can naturally push people to the extremes. Were the more traditional, the more moderate socialist movements within France in the aftermath of liberation, were they the biggest victims of the rise of communism?
I think in the aftermath of liberation, there is first of all, in the short term, there's enormous volatility. I mean, remember, the war is still going on. Liberation is largely in 1944. The war is still going on. There is obviously, as you probably know, popular fury directed against collaborators. Possibly up to 10,000 were killed, about 40,000 detained. There are Frenchmen fighting in the army, the new army of the French Republic, against the Germans, playing a major role in operations in Alsace in early 45. So I think it's fair to say that if you're looking at the short term, the pressures of the continuing war are to the fore. Afterwards, I think, it's more complex. I mean, what had happened was that a national unanimity government, so-called, had been established in September 44. That consisted of a popular republican movement, so-called, the communists and the socialists, and all of those were in a kind of uneasy situation, and that, of course, then gets put under pressure immediately after the war by the question of what is to be the structure of the new Fourth Republic. De Gaulle had been head of the provisional government, but he resigns in January 46 because he wants a stronger executive, in other words, a stronger presidency, i.e. himself. The left also lose traction in 46, and a sort of centrist politics comes to the fore. So I would say, yes, the communists are a major element and a problematic element, but in a way they are compromised by their allegiance to the Soviet Union. They're, you know, they're powerful, but they don't, they, as it were, lose credibility as an alliance partner, which of course is what happens also in West Germany. Now, in the aftermath of that, you get the governments of the Fourth Republic, and I think it's fair to say that the representative system and the absence of strong political parties based on a kind of first-past-the-post system of the British type leads to what is now, of course, we're told, marvellous, which is coalition governments, blah, 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 blah. But the reality is that these are singularly problematic in the late 40s and early 50s. France is also having to deal with the burdens of rebuilding itself. It had been extensively despoiled by the Germans, and it's got a major imperial burden, like Britain, and it's fighting an unsuccessful war, or an ultimately unsuccessful war, in Southeast Asia. And the context there, and nobody realizes that there is going to be this long boom of economic growth through the 50s and well into the 60s. And as a consequence of that, I think the late 40s, beginning of the 50s, is really quite a pessimistic period. What is interesting to contemplate, if you like, counterfactuals, the what-ifs of life, is whether the Fourth Republic could have actually done much better if they hadn't had the equivalent of the Algerian disaster.
Well, I want to talk about Algeria shortly, but just before we do get to that, as you say, that disaster, why was the Fourth Republic set up in the way it did? Why was de Gaulle's hope of there being a strong presidency, why was that defeated, and why did the Fourth Republic, having experienced in the Third Republic political instability, why did they settle on a system that continued that?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, shall we put it that not everybody was as convinced as de Gaulle was about his own merits? I mean, you might well be right. In fact, you are right that the Third Republic held up a warning, but I wouldn't exactly say that Vichy held up the idea of an ex-general running the state as necessarily being a brilliant idea. And obviously, de Gaulle was unacceptable, aside from the fact that many people realized that he had a sort of Louis XIV complex. Many people politically, you know, I mean, he was not really interested, as he was to show when he ran the Fifth Republic, in the notion of what one might call democratic accountability. And given that case, it's not really surprising that the politicians found him very difficult to work with in late 45, early 46.
So, I mean, I remember I don't remember because I wasn't born, but there was a joke in rather smug Britain in the early 1950s that said, you know, I'm off to Paris for the weekend to watch the changing of the government. I think there were 21 governments in the space of 12 years. Should we think of these as individual governments, or were they really glorified cabinet reshuffles and actually it was the same people popping up in slightly different portfolios?
Well, to a considerable extent, it's the latter. I mean, I think, you know, there are obviously outsiders who might well have changed government. I mean, so you can think of the shopkeeper Pierre Pujin, who runs this sort of Pujinism, which is a sort of movement in the early 50s that claimed to represent the ordinary French against the state, and in fact had links back to Vichy attitudes, including anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is important at this period because the Prime Minister in 1954-55, Pierre Mendès France, was Jewish. But, you know, there's no way Pujol is going to become prime minister. So in many senses, yes, this is an example of shuffling the deck chairs. But nevertheless, that is often the nature of politics. And, you know, to an outsider might just be shuffling the deck chairs, to an insider can nevertheless be profound differences in politics. And we see that in the debate, as you may know, in 1950. 1960s Britain about the supposed confluence of conservatism and Labour, you know, the Butler-Gateskill business. But in practical terms, there were differences between the two parties, and there were differences between the two of them in government. So I think one should be aware there are party identities in France. But there is no real drive within the political system to change the constitution. They're more interested, understandably, in trying to bed it down, in trying to provide a measure of domestic stability, and in trying to get the Algerian question settled.
Mm-hmm. So how did the division over how to settle the Algeria question, was that a left-right divide, or how scrambled was it?
Well, I think it was certainly scrambled. I mean, I think, again, you've got to be careful. As in Britain or any other country, what we call as abstractions, the left and the right, I do it and I apologize, sometimes one only has so much time, but they are... they have multiple chambers within them. There were certainly on the right important sections that wanted to hold on to Algeria. They had the notion that they had an obligation to the French citizens there. Some of the people that took these views were racists. Some of the people that took these views very much believed in the Catholic mission in North Africa. Some of the people believed that without Algeria, France would be weaker. And all of those, you could argue, were right-wing views. And Poujade himself was determined to keep Algeria French. On the other hand, there was also a view on the left that that France should not be driven out by terrorists, which is what the movement was. And it's worth bearing in mind that the majority of people killed by the FLN were in fact other Arabs, not people who were ethnically French. There was a view that there was a sort of suspicion of many elements on the left of many elements linked to the FLN. So I think one's got to be careful before one sees it as a straight left-right configuration. But nevertheless, certainly on the far right, there was a much stronger wish to keep Algeria French than you would see across most of the left.
And the divide was between, on the one hand, a view that Algeria must be kept at all costs, and on the other hand, it must be given independence at all costs, or what sort of clever, maybe over-clever, constitutional devices were devised to increase home rule or to have various forms of devolution, which fell short of total independence?
Well, independence for Algeria was not really regarded by most people as an option, A, because there was a large French settler population, and B, because it was administered as an integral part of France. So in 1960, most of French Africa was granted independence. I mean, Djibouti wasn't. But most of French Africa, a vast area, was granted independence. But Algeria is not. Just as, incidentally, earlier in the 50s, the French had pulled back from their positions in Tunisia and Morocco, but again, not in Algeria. So, they're moving towards a situation where Algeria is seen as different to the other colonies. What happens is that in January 61, a referendum in France approves self-determination for Algeria. And that, as you put it, is a kind of wheeze, lovely phrase there, in which partly de Gaulle is trying to see a way to reverse French decline and to find a compromise. What happens is that this referendum idea is unwelcome to the European settlers there and to an important section of the French army. And the generals carry out a putsch in Algiers in April 1961, and there's a threat that this would spread to France, and you know, you get a sort of high level of militarization. The government deploys tanks to protect the National Assembly in Paris. De Gaulle pointedly appears on television in uniform, but control is maintained. Now, at the same time, tensions are high because there is terrorism within France, continental France itself, mainland France, both by the FLN, the Indigenous Algerian Movement, and by the organization Armée Secrète, the extremist terrorist group of European settlers, and notably a bomb attack on the Paris-Strasbourg train in June 1961. And the whole situation gets more and more violent in France. In October 61, over 120 demonstrating Algerians are killed by the police in Paris. And de Gaulle, I think, appreciates that by 61, he's in danger of losing control of the situation, which, of course, is anathema to him. And he also believes would be disastrous to the government and to France itself. And he therefore decides to change policy and to get rid of Algeria, partly for these prudential reasons, but partly because he has a sense that Algeria is a distraction from what he sees as his mission to strengthen and modernize France, to retain it, to return it to its greatness. And, you know, you could argue other prudential things. You could say, for example, it has been said that the progress the French were making in their development of atomic weaponry, technology largely supplied by the United States, means that there's less need for Algerians in the French army, etc., etc. But I think in many senses, it's de Gaulle seeing it is increasingly a distraction. And then what happens is a referendum is held in France in April 62 on Algeria's independence. There's a very high approval rate. It's 91%. On the 3rd of July, France recognized Algerian independence. And on the 22nd of August, de Gaulle very narrowly survives a assassination attempt. His Citroën is bullet-ridden. The scene is depicted in the film, beginning of the film, The Day of the Jackal. And then what happens is that de Gaulle then consolidates his position in France in a very brutal way, which shows you the difference between French politics of that period and British politics. In October 62, his Prime Minister, Georges Pompidou, who de Gaulle had appointed that spring, was forced to resign by a motion of no confidence in the National Assembly, whereupon de Gaulle immediately reappointed him. And Pompidou remains Prime Minister until 68. And on top of that, de Gaulle dissolves the National Assembly when it votes a censure against his proposal for the direct election of the President. So de Gaulle is moving to a new political system which is much more authoritarian, and in a way he is able to navigate between the intractable commitment in Algeria and by ditching that, to put himself in a stronger position, and ditching it without appearing as weak, to put himself in a stronger position vis-a-vis the constitutional changes he wants in France.
Do you feel that in the early 60s, before de Gaulle strengthens his position, that France was on the verge of a coup d'etat? Or with hindsight, hindsight's a glorious thing, with hindsight, do you think that threat is overstated?
Well, there are several ways you could look at it. You could say they'd had a form of constitutional coup d'etat in putting de Gaulle in. I'm sure people wouldn't quite like that one. I mean, a coup d'etat can take a number of forms, can't it, after all? I think I mean, he wasn't quite Napoleon in 1799, but you know, there is an element of coming along, clearing out a previous political system, in Napoleon's case, the Directory, and saying, I have improved matters. If the question you're asking is, does France at that period appear seriously unstable? Then yes, the answer is, of the major Western European countries, France at that period appears politically unstable. But countries can switch round, because what I always say to people when they tell me something that's going to happen, I always say to them, well, show me the process. You know, in other words, explain the steps this is going to happen. And in a sense, once de Gaulle had enforced his political authority, carried out, if you like, a coup without bloodshed, if you want to use that term, once he'd done that, then there isn't a process by which he can be overthrown, short of assassination, which doesn't happen. And indeed, rather like Louis Napoleon in a way, although there is a bit more fighting with Louis Napoleon when he comes in and become, rather like Louis Napoleon, he gets a measure of political support. I mean, you know, the elections of November 62, after his for the National Assembly, should see the Gaullists win. And I think that's very important. And the measure that he puts through for the constitutional amendment for a direct election for the president also has a majority. So what you could argue is that this is an authoritarian, a man of autocratic tendencies, who definitely fosters a democratic deficit in the Fifth Republic. And indeed, you could argue that democratic deficit, I mean, you know, listeners will have their own views one way or the other on Brexit, but you could argue that the democratic deficit goes into the sort of French structuring of the European, what becomes the European Union. But, on the other hand, there is considerable popularity for this, again, because people want stability. I mean, something that it's very difficult to appreciate. And, you know, you recall we did those 7 programs on American history, and ended up with a retrospective on President Trump. And, of course, the major problem for President Trump at the end was that he was challenging the stability that an important chunk of voters want, even if those voters might identify themselves as temperamentally conservative. They want stability. And, you know, therefore, it's always difficult if you have a political system or solution on offer, which seems to many to be unstable. I mean, in that sense, Mr. Corbyn was unelectable to most people, including many people who might or might not have sympathized with him. I thought he was a terrible individual and politician, but he was unelectable to many simply because he also appeared to be a figure that challenged stability, sort of Britain's would-be Donald Trump. There's a way to look at him.
Beyond the elevation of himself and his role as a force for stability in the country, de Gaulle in his memoirs famously started it by saying that he had a certain idea of France. What was that idea?
It's an idea of national greatness. It's an idea of continuity. It's the idea of the pays. It was an idea that came, I mean, his family had a royalist background. He himself greatly admired Louis XIV. A sense of the grandeur of France, I think, was important to him personally. And also, I mean, it's quite interesting, his critics accused him of Bonapartism. I ought to mention that's a frequent criticism in French politics. I remember being in Paris and there was a magazine I was looking at which had on the cover a picture of Sarkozy as if he was Napoleon. Well, I think there's not much comparison between the two. De Gaulle slightly closer, but I mean, interestingly enough, I mean, de Gaulle would have hated that idea because de Gaulle would have seen himself as a more legitimate figure than Napoleon.
And Gaullism in political terms is similar to Botskalite conservatism in Britain in the 1950s and early 60s, or is there something different about its political nature?
Well, first of all, I think there was a greater determination on stability. I think that's, in a way, Macmillan was rocking the boat a bit. And I think that de Gaulle was a figure who had a stronger sense of certainty than Macmillan did. I also think that religion was important for many of the Gaullist supporters, to an extent that was stronger than that was the case for the way the Conservative Party was changing. I think that had traditionally been true of the Conservative Party, the Church of England, in politics, but I think that that was becoming much less consequential. And obviously land and the landed interest and rural France played a larger role in Gaullism than, and you see that as late as Chirac, than the comparable thing in Britain, where you might have landowners, but they were certainly not people that really understood or had much of a grounding in the local rural community.
And many of the really important strategic decisions, of course, were taken before de Gaulle returned to power. In 1949, France joined NATO. 1957, it signs the Treaty of Rome, creating the European Economic Community. To what extent do you feel there is continuity here? And to what extent did Gaullism turn its back on the Atlanticist approach that NATO involved?
Well, de Gaulle pulled France out of the military component of NATO, which was a very serious matter indeed, given the vulnerability of Western Europe to Soviet attack. On the world scale, he spent a lot of his time trying to, as it were, tweak the American tail, trying to present France as an interlocutor with the Soviet Union, trying to play up France's role in Africa. And of course, as far as the EEC, as it then was, the European Economic Community, is concerned, I think it's fair to say that he certainly didn't match the sort of communitaire assumptions of some of the early founders of the situation. So no, I think I think in a way he was a figure who he personally sort of had nothing in common with Lyndon Johnson, nothing in common with Harold Wilson. I mean, he very much saw himself as a man of destiny, and he wasn't really interested in fitting in with anybody else or their assumptions.
So is there a void that's created around this, this great man, or are there other major figures, other great institutions of state which are operating successfully in his shadow?
Well, he nearly falls in 68. As you probably know, during the crisis caused by the événement in France, and it's worth bearing in mind that in France, whereas in West Germany there's student trouble, but not really, as there is in Britain, but not really anything linked to sustained trade union problems or action, there is major problem in France because you get both of those plus political pressure from the left for government change. And so what de Gaulle does is he, goes off to see the commanders of the French forces in West Germany and require their military support and indicate that if he doesn't get it, he's going, fleeing. Now, it's rather as if in 2016, on the morning of the referendum results, Cameron had gone along to Kensington Barracks and said that he wanted troops on the streets, and he didn't tend to pay any attention to the referendum result. De Gaulle you know, gets the promise of military support and then, you know, shows the determination and regains the initiative. And I think that that reflects to a great extent a lot of opinion, not all opinion, but a lot of opinion, particularly outside Paris. So it's very similar to what occurs in 1848 in Paris, eventually, with the suppression of the radicals, and again in 1871. But no, I think de Gaulle badly handles it in 68. And yet again, I mean, the comparison with Cameron, again, is interesting because Cameron is somebody who is a politician who couldn't do politics. So the comparison, I mean, de Gaulle next following year in 69, he goes for a referendum on a relatively minor constitutional change with reference it's to the composition of the Senate, and it's to a move from department to regions. The, you know, the latter has, in fact, subsequently occurred. But the referendum, and again, the comparison of 2016 is interesting, the referendum was understood to be in part about de Gaulle's continuance in office. He divided the right, inflation is rising, and 53% vote no. So, you know, he goes after that in a huff. he didn't have to go, but he goes in a huff. So I have to say that his political skills are not so much to the fore as people sometimes argue that they were. I mean, he wasn't somebody designed for democratic politics. And it's no accident that he is succeeded by a man who is his prime minister, had been his prime minister, Pompidou, who is considerably more sort of urbane and sensible in terms of being able to you know, control politics.
Mm-hmm. Well, one question I must ask before we move on from de Gaulle is, both at the time and subsequently, many people thought that he was fleeing the country and having some kind of mental breakdown. What is your view on that, or has the reason for his trip to West Germany been simply misinterpreted?
No, I think that element, I think he had a crisis of confidence. I think that's fairly clear. I mean, you know, there's an interesting discussion in the recent biography by Julian Jackson, but I think the point was he didn't know what was going to happen. There were some rather uneasy comparisons in French history during the Fronde. Mazarin had fled Paris. Louis XVI, of course, did get out of Paris, but got caught at Varennes. He seems to have failed to grasp the extent to which the left, although they were capable of really creating chaos in the center of government in Paris, were actually not the majority force in French politics. And it's an interesting point. I mean, it's worth bearing in mind that people will endlessly wobble on. You know, you get all these idiotic commentators out there about how the 1960s was a period of left-wingery and all the rest of it. I mean, it's worth bearing in mind that if you look at the French election in 69, Pompidou wins with 57.6% of the vote, which is pretty good. Heath wins in 70, and Nixon wins in 68. And so I think one's got to be wary of I mean, I think actually de Gaulle fluffed it, bluntly. I mean, I think that he shouldn't have needed to go to Germany. But, you know, there you go. As you say, the benefits of hindsight and all the rest of it.
When de Gaulle calls it a day, he's nevertheless presided over a period of extraordinary transformation in France. To what extent can that be seen as something which was done by a managerial or anarch class of individuals, and you know, might have happened to whoever was running the country at the time? Or should we see something about the nature of the stamp that the general himself created, which is reflected in the France of the 1960s?
Oh, that's very interesting. I mean, I think certainly keeping the left away from power was very important in the economic growth of the period. I mean, what you've got is liberal capitalism working across the Western world to produce the great boom. And obviously, you see that with different manifestations. I mean, West Germany is particularly successful. France and Italy do well. Britain does less well. The United States does very well, etc. A lot of what one's got is, the application of new organizational methods, particularly coming from the United States, and new technology, the movement of labor off the land, but in a full employment context, providing employment for expanding industry, a major growth of the middle class, working class benefiting from both rising incomes and very low unemployment. And then much of this wealth in turn is spent on consumer goods such as cars, but also refrigerators. And that then those consumer industries grow, although heavy industry, which is the traditional background of the communists, is not doing so well. So I think, in a way, you don't have to be Charles de Gaulle to do that. I mean, after all, Adenauer and Erhard in particular, are more helpful in that in the West German context. But de Gaulle does, he does provide, I suppose he gets them out of Algeria. That would have had to have happened, and it's worth bearing in mind that the Fourth Republic had got them out of Vietnam in 54. He gets them out of Algeria. He gets them through the sort of political turmoil of 61-62, and he does produce a certain degree of stability as a consequence, which helps growth and encourages investment. But quite frankly, I think the returns on investment were such that that would have occurred even if the general hadn't been there.
Mm-hmm. Well, in next week's Black's History podcast, we will discuss France after de Gaulle. But for now, Professor Jeremy Black, author of France, A Short History, which is to be published in April, thank you very much.
Thank you. One last thing. Might I encourage listeners this time to think about, if they're interested, looking at some of the French films of the period. French cinema in the 1950s, I mean, there are actually some very good films in the late 40s as well, but French cinema in the 1950s is highly impressive, and in these days of lockdown, I think that you could call it a historical text that you are looking at. Anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Black.
If you've enjoyed listening to the Critic podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the offer of 3 issues for just £5 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.